Hello and welcome to the No Ceilings NBA Draft Show. Today is a deep dives episode. I am your co-host Nick Agar Johnson, and with me, as always, is my co-host Paige Otto. Paige, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
I'm doing great, Nick. Appreciate you being flexible to record in the afternoon. And there's actually no snow on the ground for the first time in about 2 months in Michigan. So
Wow. We're
getting on that verge of springtime. It's been like 50, low 50s this past week. So I'm happy about it. I've seen sun. I've been outside. I've ran outside. So it's good. Good vibes around here.
For the second week in a row, it is somehow colder here than it is where you are. Today, it is 35 and it just stopped raining. It had been absolute downpour for three straight days. So,
Okay.
You know, sometimes you win the weather war and sometimes you objectively lose.
I'll take my wins in Michigan when I can get them.
That is a very fair argument. So we have two prospects today that on the one hand are very different, and on the other hand have one pretty key similarity, which I think is where we're going to start with it. But before we start with that, shall we do a quick transition before we throw to the first of our players?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I teased it before the break, but I think there is one very key similarity between the two players that we are covering today. And that is that they are, if not the top two breakout stars of college basketball this year, then certainly they're running for those top spots. So today we are talking about Vanderbilt sophomore guard Tyler Tanner and Baylor junior guard Cameron Carr. So we're starting with Tyler Tanner today, who actually was my pick for this exercise, which is a bit different than usual just because I tend not to be, I'm not quite Maxwell, don't get me wrong, but I'm not that much of a small guard person generally. But I think the thesis statement for me with Tyler Tanner is, yeah, he's a 6 foot guard. He does absolutely everything you could want to see from a 6 foot guard. And the question is just, has that become an archetype at the NBA level that doesn't quite work anymore? But that's sort of the log line, the thesis that I have. Paige, what are your thoughts on Tyler Tanner this season?
Yeah. Tyler Tanner, you know, he's your explosive, shifty primary guard that can score at all three levels and puts real pressure, especially at the rim too. And he's a blur in transition. I mean, you look at him one way and then he's somehow all the way down the court, or, you know, you can't really keep track of him because he just has that explosiveness and that high caliber athleticism to him. And then in a 6 foot, you know, 175 pound body. With him though, it's an archetype that you have to get everything right when you're looking at these type of guys, just because of how the NBA and the game has developed. But he's doing everything that you want to see. Rucker and Metcalf did an episode on him, I believe a month ago, of kind of like, should he, you know, go to the draft this year or should he return? It's kind of like, what else does he have to do that we don't already know about his archetype, right? Which makes it difficult because just from this year, from last year to this year, he's already improved, especially as a three-point marksman as well. And then last year, I was looking just for some fun stats for the listeners on the Vanderbilt website. He was the only major conference player with 60 or more assists and 15 or less turnovers. One of four major conference freshmen to record more than 50 assists and 50 steals. The others were Cooper Flagg, Jeremiah Fears, and VJ Edgecombe, which was insane when I read that. And with him too, Nick, you know, he has a 30.4 assist rate, 4.3 steal rate, is averaging 3 stocks per game. I really love him as, you know, this help kind of free flying defender more than a point of attack guy, just because I think he just thrives in being a chaos disruptor, right? He's not really looking to, you know, be that type of, you know, isolation player and get these guys, you know, one-on-one head on. I really am more comfortable with him, you know, kind of just being that free floating guy that, you know, can switch on these guys. And then obviously, you know, is great at stunting and, you know, disrupting, obviously, as a defensive playmaker. But I'm not as confident of him being a point of attack guy just because of his size and strength at this level, which is going to be difficult in the NBA, right? But with how Vanderbilt plays, like even when they're playing a little bit of zone against Auburn, he's kind of the free-flowing, you know, nail guy in the middle that is just running around trying to get steals whenever he can and make an impact, because that's what he does best, right? And obviously the stats and film shows it. But he's improved so much from last year to this year. You know, he has NBA parking lot range. He can shoot from anywhere on the court, and especially off the catch, off spot ups. And then as a rim finisher too, obviously he does deal with length at the rim that he kind of has difficulty as, but he's awesome at drawing fouls, which is another, you know, bump into his game as well with him being undersized. He gets to the line about, 5.3 times per game, up from only a one attempt at the line from last year too. So he really is a player that, even though he's undersized, right at 6 foot, 175 pounds, he can get to his spot because he's a master at creating his own pace of play, and he has the ball on a string. So it's a difficult evaluation just because he is that undersized guard, but you can also find tremendous value with him in the second round too.
So I want to very quickly go back to the shooting point that you brought up, because I think it's an exceptionally important one in the sense of, you know, given how many times I've railed about sample size in 3-point shooting before, the fact that he had nearly 2 attempts per game last year and shot 26.6% on those threes, not great. My sort of take on that is, if he's that kind of shooter, he's not an NBA player anyway. So I don't think about it all that much, because it's like, he kind of has to be the level of shooter that he is right now for things to work. I do want to get back to the point of attack defense question in just a second, but there is, you know, you brought up the stat from, you know, it was Cooper Flagg, VJ Edgecombe, and Tyler Tanner. And of course, now I'm blanking on who
Jeremiah Fierce.
There we go. Thank you. Apologize for that. But the thing with Tyler Tanner that, you know, blew my mind when I saw it was going through the synergy numbers, and he has 16 dunks on the year.
Yeah.
Like, Keaton Wagler has none, and he's half a foot taller, right? That's the kind of athlete that Tyler Tanner is. And you brought up the three stocks, you know, he's leading the conference. He's pretty close to leading the country in steals per game at 2.5. But he also has a few blocks, which for someone of his size is absolutely absurd. And so again, that sort of goes back to the theory I was having of, you know, if you're going to be a kind of, you know, as small of a guard as he is, you have to have pretty much every tool in your toolkit. And, you know, as you mentioned, he's an absolute blur in transition, right? He's got the speed. He's also got the hops to, you know, again, blocking any shots at all. His size is super impressive. And, you know, 16 dunks for a 6-0 guard is hyper impressive as well. So I do want to get back to the point of attack defense thing now, but just to sort of state up top again, it's like, yeah, there could be concerns with the shooting falling off. The fact that he's getting to the free throw line a lot more this year and hitting 86% of them and shooting 37%, as you mentioned, parking lot range, right? He's not just shooting 21 footers that are not threes at the NBA level. Like, he's pulling up from anywhere. And that sort of leads to the notion of, yeah, you know, if you're going to have a guard that size who's successful, they can't be someone who you can sort of force to an area on the floor where they can't be effective. But I'm curious on the point of attack defense stuff, because I'm of two minds about it, which is, I agree with you that I think he does his best work as a help defender. I also do wonder just how much NBA teams are going to be willing to let a 6-0 guy float. You know what I mean? Of like, you know, we've talked about this before with Jhené Mobley, right? Of like, he essentially has to be that point of attack guy to get playing time at his size. And it's a bit of a different thing for Jhené Mobley versus Tanner, because, you know, Tyler Tanner is one of the best defensive playmakers in college basketball. Jhené Mobley is not. But the flip side of that also is, I do wonder just how many, you know, because guys who are 6'3 shooting guards in college are going to be 6'6 at the NBA level, and they're going to be a lot more than 175 pounds. And so I do wonder just how many opportunities he will have to defend off ball just based on his size. And so I'm curious your thoughts on sort of how teams might use him, even if he might be at his best as more of a help guy. Is that a spot he's going to be put in very often?
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point, because it's kind of like his size obviously limits him in that regard, but it's because since he does it so well as a help defender, that's his bread and butter, right? It's kind of like you have to put him at the point of attack because of his size, but that's not his strength and size, because he's going to get beat off the dribble into the rim because of these, you know, hyper athletic, you know, 6'6 plus wingspan players in the NBA that are just going to, you know, take it to him one-on-one, and he's not going to have the ability to switch off every single time that, you know, he tends to do sometimes at Vanderbilt, right? A lot of his defensive possessions, you know, he, if he's a point of attack defender and then, you know, he comes off a ball screen over, he's like, okay, switch on him, right? But he's not going to be able to do that at the NBA level, which concerns me because he does it so well. I mean, he has the steal record at Vanderbilt, 55 last year, 62 steals on the season this season, which is insane.
Wild.
And with him, I could see him kind of being that like 1-2 punch. I feel like in certain matchups and scenarios, I could see him being more of a help defender and like a two guy, but it just depends, you know, what teams are going to let him be him in that regard, which is kind of difficult because how, like, I wouldn't feel as comfortable of having like a 6-foot guy, you know, being my help defender if someone gets past me, right? Because he's not going to apply any, you know, sort of rim protection most of the time at the rim, but with his defensive rebounding rate too, which I'll bring up one second. Let's see here. Yeah, he has 80 defensive rebounds on the season. He's averaging 3.2 defensive rebounds per game. And that's because he is so quick and bursty and is able, because he has great active hands too, right? Is that he's able to knock a lot of these, you know, big men off when they're getting these rebounds, just, you know, swoop in and, you know, push the pace, right? Which I think adds even more value for him at the NBA level. But again, to your point, it's kind of like, our team's actually going to let him do what he's best at because of his size. So that's kind of, you know, you have to take into account that too in the evaluation. But I think it could go either ways. I think for him, it's just going to depend where he, you know, fits. And I think too, at the NBA level, I could see him, you know, being a, you know, a fan favorite as well, you know, like kind of this, you know, Jose Alvarado type that comes in and it's, you know, he's going to do what he does best, right? And everyone knows that he's that guy that, you know, will pickpocket you and, you know, cause chaos on the defensive end. I could see him fitting into that role, but obviously he's a lot more, you know, offensively versatile than Jose Alvarado, right? He can do a lot more things, especially as a shooter. So I think he could have a lot more minutes just because of what he offers there as a help defender. That they're more reluctant of, you know, hey, we'll let you, you know, be a help defender, you know, two guy just because of all the things you can do, but it's going to kind of be limited. You're not going to have that many opportunities there that, you know, you have at Vanderbilt.
So there's one other defensive question that I'm curious for your thoughts on. And, you know, part of this admittedly is because something I've said before on this podcast and in articles is I struggle sometimes with, you know, sort of separating out players' individual defensive successes versus, you know, their work in a team structure. And they don't qualify for the leaderboards because they haven't played enough games. But Vanderbilt has two other guys who are averaging 2.5 steals a game, right? You know, sixth-year guard Duke Miles is averaging 2.8 steals per game. He just hasn't played as many games. Frankie Collins, fifth-year guard, is, you know, he's only played 9 games, but he's averaging 2.5 steals in those games. And so I'm curious, do you think that's just, you know, something that Tyler Chandler happens to be great at and those two other guys happen to be great at? Because I do wonder how much of it is sort of a scheme thing with Vanderbilt where, you know, they're not like leading the country in steals per game. It's basically those three guys are getting all the steals and they're all, you know, very similar guards. Like they're all between 6 foot and 6'2". They're all right around 170, 180 pounds. And so I wonder how much of it is just those guys are asked to and get the freedom to jump passing lanes, leading to sort of inflating those totals. And, you know, one of the main reasons why I think Tyler Chandler stands out from those other two guys, you know, beyond obviously the offensive arsenal, is he's also blocking shots, right? It's not just I'm only getting into passing lanes. It's no, I'm, as you mentioned, right, I'm causing chaos. I'm being a problem off-ball player. But it does stick out to me a little bit that, you know, there are multiple guys on Vanderbilt who are in that same sort of echelon as steals guys. And it's not because Vanderbilt is averaging like 12 steals a game and leading the country by like 7,000. Like they're 41st in terms of steals per game.
Yeah, I would say it's part that too, because a lot of what Vanderbilt's scheme is that they like love to blitz and kind of hedge out the corners too, which causes, you know, the Tyler Tanners of the world to, you know, get into rotation. And like Tyler Chandler doesn't have to be in the perfect position just because he is so athletic and, you know, athletically gifted that he can kind of stunt a little bit more than, you know, your average, you know, guard can, right? Just because he has that burst and stuff. So that's kind of why he, you know, that could be why like his steals rate is like off the roof, especially with, you know, Duke Miles as well. And Vanderbilt guards in general, it could be a scheme thing, right? Because that's kind of the concept that you see game after game, is that they love to have their guards kind of, you know, blitz the corners and then kind of stunt back into rotation and switch and all that type of stuff. So that could certainly be it, because in like other schemes as well, you don't see that all the time too, which, you know, it obviously helps out because you have these undersized guards that it's kind of like, how do we get them to, you know, be the most valuable on that defensive end? And that's how, you know, Vanderbilt does it.
Yeah. I mean, I think another part that really supports the argument is in favor of Tyler Tanner, to be clear, is last year he was tied for the team lead in steals and playing far fewer minutes a game, right? Yeah. So it's not just like, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like, and it's funny because this actually turns out to be a terrible example, but like something I thought about a lot with Tari Eason when he was at LSU, because, you know, I think I've mentioned this before on the pod, but my dad's entire side of the family is from Cincinnati. So I tend to follow Cincinnati basketball more than the average person who's not from Cincinnati, Ohio. And, you know, Tari Eason at Cincinnati was not, you know, this crazy defensive playmaker like he was at LSU. And so that was something I wondered of, how much of this is LSU scheme and how much of this is Tari Eason. And then within 5 minutes of watching him in summer league for the first time, I was like, oh, this guy's just on a different level athletically than literally everybody else. And that's why this is happening. But, you know, again, with Tanner, it's like, I think that even though he played so much of a smaller role last year, the defensive playmaking was at a pretty similar level. It's more everything else that's taken the giant leap. And so speaking of that, I do want to circle back to the offense. And something that I have, you know, something I've always thought about, but have looked at more explicitly with point guard prospects I'm looking at this year, is in terms of the synergy numbers, the difference between their all scoring possessions numbers and their possessions plus assists numbers. So Tyler Tanner ranks in the 80th percentile in terms of points per possession. He's averaging 1.05 points per possession, which is a really great number. But when you add in his possessions plus assists, he jumps to the 95th percentile. And, you know, that's because he does something that we've talked about before, which is the very difficult double duty act of simultaneously making difficult passes and also keeping control of the ball, right? And it's one of those things where, in general, I tend to prefer playmakers who can and will make the home run passes, but, you know, maybe turn the ball over slightly more than you'd like, because, you know, again, those guys can create something out of nothing in a way that not everybody can. But when you couple that sort of can make every pass in the book, can make all those reads, and also not turn the ball over a lot, and also doing that as, you know, someone who's a much smaller guard, right? It's not like he's seeing over the defense and picking out all those passes. Again, that's something I'm starting to look at more and more, and it's a metric that Tyler Tanner blows out of the park of, yeah, he's a really efficient creator for himself on offense, but not only that, he's also making, you know, he's passing other guys open in a way that really shows up when you dig into the numbers.
And one thing about him too is that he possesses that high level IQ on both sides of the ball and is a great playmaker as an offensive player and defensive minded player, which you don't see a lot, you know, from these undersized guards too, which, and you know, in his favor is great. And you mentioned the type of passes he makes are insane. I mean, whip around 180 passes with one hand. I mean, he'll attack a closeout, you know, do a little up and under. You think he's going to shoot the layup, and then he just somehow kicks it out to a wide open shooter on the perimeter. And he's doing all this, you know, at his height, which is also, you know, insane. And I think with him too, it's kind of like, do you see, like, how does this translate at the NBA level? Because like, he's doing all these insane things. But as you mentioned, how much is he actually going to have that ability to do all those things at the next level? And I think with him is that since he is such a high polished, high IQ, elite player and playmaker, that he's going to find his way somehow on an NBA roster, because his type of skill set is hard to combine. And I think fitting into a scheme, I'm trying to think of, you know, what team or fit you know, I would like to have him on. Maybe, I mean, I know I say the Pistons a lot, but like, I could see him being like a, you know, defensive disruptor that comes in, you know, off the bench, and also as a secondary playmaker for Cade, right? that, you know, can do all the gritty, you know, 3-1-3 things that, you know, Detroit does on both sides of the glass too. So I think in those types of environments and atmospheres where he could like thrive in that, you know, grittiness, competitiveness. I was talking to you, Nick, before this about, he kind of reminds me in that way of like his motor grittiness and just kind of being everywhere on the court, kind of like a Villanova, you know, Kyle Lowry, mm-hmm. right? And you brought up Darius Garland, which is also an excellent comparison as well. But in just those ways is that when I'm looking at all these types of players of, I love like players that, you know, will get down and do the dirty work on both sides of the ball. And it kind of is like, oh, just because I'm, you know, this or that, like I can still do a lot of these skills that you may not think I could do.
Yeah, I'm glad you made those comparisons because that was one thing I wanted to do before I moved on to the next player. So instead, I would say the other thing that I wanted to make sure that we mention about Tyler Tanner before we move on, which is he is shooting just a hair under 67% at the rim this year. That's a drop off from last year. Last year, he was at 68.6% on at rim attempts. And, you know, again, it's something that, you know, we talked about with Jhené Mobley. We talked about with Abuka Okori of, you know, there are guys who are three level guys and there are guys who are 2.5 level guys. And Tyler Tanner is 100% a three level guy. Like you don't, the range on his shots, as you mentioned, and that combined with the fact that he's hitting at the rim at the rate that he is, which, you know, that also makes me a lot more comfortable with his NBA translation in the sense of, you know, this is not something he's going to have to figure out, right? It's just going to be a question of, how much more difficult is it for him against NBA level rim protectors? Because newsflash, it's more difficult for everybody against NBA level rim protectors, right? But when you start from that high a level of like, you know, high 60s on finishes around the basket, you have a lot more room to work with in terms of, okay, maybe I can't quite finish over, you know, Jalen Duren in the way that I could finish over, you know, name random unathletic college center X, right? It's like, it's a slightly different ball game. But again, when you have a lot more room to work with, it's a lot easier to project that, yeah, he'll probably be slightly worse at the rim. But like, even if he's in the low 60s at the rim at the NBA level, that's still more than good enough if his shooting holds.
And one thing I wanted to mention before we move on to our next prospect, but I think with guards especially, obviously looking at off nights for every prospect is super, super valuable, but I think looking at off nights for especially prospects that you struggle with or archetypes that you struggle with, and like mine being, you know, how to value undersized guards is that, you know, he didn't have one of his best games against A&M the last game. He only had 4 points, but he also had 6 assists, 3 steals, and only 1 turnover. And one thing with Tanner is that even though his shot wasn't falling, he was moving way more off the ball than, you know, he has been doing, and just creating his shots. I mean, he's a great pacemaker. You know, he knows how to accelerate, decelerate, get to his spots. He loves to, you know, stop and pop, which I thought was even more impressive than, you know, some of his, you know, outlier games too that he's had, breakout games over the season. So I wanted to mention that because you could look at the box score and be like, oh, he, you know, was 0-for-5 from like 3-point line or, you know, whatever, he only had 4 points, but like, look how many things he already did at, you know, a lot that says a lot that you can impact the game in so many other ways when your shot wasn't falling, especially, you know, with his archetype too. So I wanted to bring that up as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And yeah, the thing with the archetype again is like a lot of what we're talking about is here are all the thresholds that you need to meet to succeed at a guard of this size. But the flip side of that is, okay, if you're bringing more than just shooting to the table, then when you have an off shooting night, you're still being helpful rather than like, okay, we gotta sit this guy. He's, you know, he's ruining our defense and he's, yeah, you know, shooting like 0-for-95 or whatever. It's when, you know, it's a cliche that I in particular have used many times on this particular podcast, but when you have multiple different ways to get on the floor, it's going to be easier to establish yourself at the NBA level because it's not just, okay, we need a specialist, bring in Tyler Tanner, right? It's like, okay, you know, we need someone who can help run the offense, who can be a spacing threat, and who can also help out on the defensive end, rather than purely just, okay, we bring him in for 4 spacing, and if his shot is not on tonight, then we got to pull him as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Shall we move on to player number 2?
Yeah, let's do it.
So you chose Cameron Carr for this week and, you know, mentioned up top, but it's funny that these are two of the biggest breakout guys in college basketball. It's also funny on the very last point that you hit before we moved on, that Cam Carr also had maybe his worst game of the season in his last game.
Yeah.
And was still able to provide some value, although I would argue he had a worse game than Tyler Tanner. But yeah, we don't need to get into that. Paige, what made you decide to go with Cameron Carr for today?
Yeah. Well, I picked Cameron Carr because, one, he reminds me of like a Jordan Hawkins-esque, like Brandon Ingram type of player, just because of those hyper 3-and-D wings. I think Cameron Carr is one of the most, if not the most dynamic shooter in the draft. 6'5", 190 pounds. Preseason, he was listed at 175. So, I mean, you can tell in the film too, Nick, that, you know, he's added strength and size to him, which is a great sign, you know, adding 15 pounds throughout the season as well, which is a lot harder to do, you know, in the off season. And he also has, you know, an insane wingspan at 7'1", which is just so, you know, noticeable every single game as well. And he's one of the best chaos disruptors on defense as well. He's averaging, let's see, 18.9 points per game, 5.8 rebounds, 2.7 assists on 50.6, 38.6, and 78 shooting splits. And then you add in, you know, 2.7 assists per game, 0.9 steals, 1.5 blocks. So he's averaging 2.4 stacks per game as well. He is one of the best, you know, movement shooters as well. You know, he can hit off the catch, spot up, as well. And with him too, you know, his shot is so repetitive. Every single shot he takes is like a mirror of itself. And in his shot release point too, it's kind of like he has a little bit of a dip, but like no dip as well. I mean, his shot release is just so fast and quick, and he flies in transition. He is just everywhere on the court. And I just love his archetype just because he covers so much ground. And, you know, he transferred from Tennessee. Playing time wasn't really there for him. And then obviously he's having a breakout year this year at Baylor. Baylor's having a down year altogether as a team. I saw an interesting stat with Baylor and Scott Drew. I think it was like his only season where they had double digit losses since his time being there, which is also crazy. But he is just, at this point in the season, like he's a top 20 lock for me, just because of his archetype alone. And you mentioned, you know, his last three games, I had an interesting stat, or last four games. So last three games, you know, he had 7 turnovers with 0 assists. The game before, 5 turnovers, 3 assists. The game prior, 4 turnovers and 2 assists. And Baylor has also lost the past 4 games. And the opponents were Kansas State, Louisville, and BYU. And with BYU too, I mean, he still put up 24 points, 8 rebounds, 2 assists, and 3 steals, right? So take that with a grain of salt. But one of the things that not completely worries me, but is a little like, you know, take note of that is like his handle. His handle isn't the strongest. It's not the tightest. He kind of has this thing where he, you know, he's an excellent category in synergy. We know he's a force in transition just because of his, you know, length and size alone and his speed. And he's a hyper athlete as well too, but he has this, he just tries to do too much, or he just gets caught, you know, lacking a little bit. And defenders see that right away. And his playmaking too, I think I put him more as like, he can be, you know, a connective playmaker at the next level. Nothing too crazy. Like, he can hit the reads he needs to hit, but he also doesn't hit simple reads. There's been a lot of times this season where he'll just sail a ball, you know, behind a player or two in front. Or there was a blob play, I believe, against Kansas State, where he just like misread the whole scheme, or I don't know what happened. And he just like actually just passed it out of bounds himself and didn't even hit a player. So I think, and like with those two, like a lot of the times, like people will just pickpocket him with his handle. Like, that's something I want him to improve upon. But with him, he's not going to be asked to do a lot of that at the NBA level just because of his archetype. But he does have flashes of self-creation, especially off the dribble, in the paint. Let me see here. Oh yeah. He, 28.6%. Wait, who is that? Sorry. I'm like looking through my notes and Notion is like frozen.
Of course it is.
Yeah. So off the dribble, 2.5 court, he's at 30.4% with 35.8% on 3. So he has that self-creation, flashes there off his dribble jumper as well. And as a pick and roll ball handler, he's shooting 32% off 2s with only small sample size of 25 attempts, but still in 50% off threes on 22 attempts. So there's flashes there, right, of his, of him creating self-creation in isolation too. But I much rather him, you know, fly to the rim, because he glides on the floor, Nick. I mean, he's so fun to watch, and especially with his dynamic shooting capability. And, you know, he's an insane cutter as well. It's like, if you guys have been listening to Deep Dives, Nick and I love players that, you know, just get how to cut and slash to the rim. And he does all of those things. So that's why I really like Cameron Carr.
So I want to go back on a couple of those points, because I think that one of the key questions for me with Cam Carr is the combination of two things that you brought up, of not the best handle and can be a connective guy, but doesn't necessarily make all the reads. And that sort of leads me into wondering about, you know, sort of how, I'm trying to find the right way to say this, I guess, how actualized his passing can be, in the sense of, if he's not someone, you know, this is something we've talked about before, of like, what do you do when you're, especially if you're a shooter, what do you do if you're forced off the 3-point line? And so with his handle not being quite adequate, it sort of leads me to believe, how much of that connective ability will he actually get to use? Because if teams don't trust him to have the ball in his hands, obviously he's not going to be making connective reads, right? Because he's never touching the ball in the first place. And so I do wonder about that, as I do with most players of that archetype who struggle either as a passer or as a dribbler, because if you're going to be that kind of connective piece, you don't have to be fantastic, but I think you need to be at least adequate at both of them to sort of get those opportunities to be that connective piece. And with Carr, I think the question is a lot more about the dribbling than it is about the passing.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I brought this up to you before we recorded. I was like, maybe I'm a little bit more concerned, like a lot more than I thought about his handle. Like, I was just like, what is going on? Like, he, and especially when he has the ball in his hands too, Nick, it's like he's not like having, what's the word, like authority to his dribbles, right? He doesn't have that like, okay, no one's going to take this ball away from me type of mentality. He like, he has the, you know, tweener in between the leg type of counters, but it's not like with like pressure or like power, right? It's kind of just like, it's just like kind of thrown out there for people to kind of like grab at. Like BYU is kind of a great example. You know, Richie Saunders, it's very unfortunate that obviously he tore his ACL and is out for the season. But he gave Cameron Carr a hard time, especially on the perimeter, just because of his presence. He even blocked one of Carr's 3-point attempts in the corner. And he just, you know, had a couple steals on Carr just because of him just looking around and kind of just like taking the ball, you know, from underneath him, which concerns me at depth. But he does so many things on the court that I can't just, you know, be too weary about that, but it's also raised more like a yellow flag to me, not like a red flag at this point. But it's definitely concerning just because of how much he has to offer and his projectability at the next level, if he can't handle the ball.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason that we're being a bit more nitpicky with Carr than we are with Tanner is just because it's pretty easy to see how it doesn't work with Tanner, right? Whereas with Carr, it's like, there are ways in which, you know, if he can clean up the handle, all of a sudden he looks like, you know, much, much higher guy in the first round, maybe even, you know, I don't want to say lottery, but, you know, like potentially if, and
after the combine, I mean, I think he's going to be a combine monster. So like you never know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He is going to be very impressive at the combine, which we'll get into in a minute, but I do want to go back to one other thing, which I haven't actually broken it out that much this year, but one of my old favorite deep dives cliches was the notion that anything that's a matter of feet at the college level is a matter of inches at the NBA level. And so, you know, you mentioned him not having the most confidence in his handle, and that might be the root of the problem, honestly, because, you know, if he's like, oh no, do I have enough space to get around this guy? Should I, you know, try and take him off the dribble? Or, you know, if you're running through that thought process in your head, by the time you get to the end of that chain, you've probably already missed the passing opportunity, right? And however much of an issue that is at the college level is even more of an issue at the NBA level. So then it sort of becomes a question of, okay, you know, even if his handle isn't good, is it maybe more important for him to try things and, you know, maybe dribble off the ball off his foot a few times versus like if he doesn't have the faith in his handle to actually try taking guys off the dribble, that might actually be more of a problem than screwing up while trying to take guys off the dribble.
Yeah, it's difficult because he has he's a rangy, you know, plus wingspan type of guy that can just glide on the court and is so aggressive when he's off movement, right? When he's kind of that stationary in the corners, kind of, okay, you got to self-create now, or, you know, we're going to lose a possession or, you know, one or two. He kind of not like freaks out, but is kind of not as confident as he is, you know, in transition as a cutter, you know, on the 3-point line or, you know, at the rim as well, with his craftiness there. So it's kind of like, how does he have that mentality to just have that into his handle? Because his handle isn't like, you know, it's not dead or anything. Like, he has skill there. It's just kind of like with his archetype, like, you need him to have a tough handle, because that just opens up a lot more opportunity as well. And like, for his, and then his background too, you know, obviously his dad played in the NBA as well, and was a runner up. He was a slam dunk runner up as well. Slam dunk champion runner up. So he has that bloodline, right, too. You know, he has that in his genes, and like, he's such a vertical pop athlete as well. And, you know, a lot of the times, and, you know, as we nitpick a little bit here and there, it's not saying like, I don't think he can ever have like a tight handle or a strong handle. It's just like, it's one of those things where it's like, why doesn't this add up to everything else he does on the court for some reason? But yeah, I think the past 4 games, obviously Baylor has struggled. Cameron Carr has also, you know, made an impact in other ways than just like the turnovers. But I mean, having multiple, last few games of, you know, 5 or more turnovers is definitely, you know, frightening, you know, as we go through conference play into conference tournaments into March Madness. So, it's just see, you know, how he holds up here.
Yeah, maybe I'm just biased. I mean, I know I am biased in favor of Tunde Issufu, but it feels like those two guys really aren't getting enough help from the rest of the team. And it puts them in spots where, like, you know, Tunde has been a lot better on defense this year than he was in high school. But also, he has to gamble a lot because he's not, you know, other than Cam Carr, it's like he's not really getting all that much help from everybody around him. And I am going to be writing about Tunde at some point in the, you know, not near future, but medium term future. And I am curious if after I do a sort of deeper dive, I have a similar view on it to the one I have right now, which is essentially like, man, if they had a little bit more help from any of the bigs on the roster, a lot of this would go a lot easier. But I do want to go back to a phrase that you've used quite a few times with Cam Carr, because I think that's a good way to transition into the non-nitpicky and, you know, talk about the things that he's exceptional at, which is, this is mean, but I'm going to say it because he's had an incredibly successful professional career and therefore he can take it. But like, Miles Turner at Texas, it was like, this guy is a sensational athlete and he moves like my unathletic cousins. You know, it's like, you watch him running up and down the floor. It's like, how is this guy such a mega athlete? And it's funny because at the NBA level, Miles Turner figured that out almost immediately. But, you know, just generally, conceptually, it's like some guys are wild athletes. And, you know, even for a different kind of example, right? Like watching Zion Williamson at Duke, it's like, this guy is a ridiculous athlete, but it doesn't necessarily look smooth as much as it looks powerful. Cam Carr is incredibly smooth. And I, you know, there was one moment when I was prepping for this podcast yesterday where, yeah, I was just going through some of Cam Carr's offensive possessions. And at one point, he literally, it's like he takes 2 steps and just throws down this 2-handed dunk where like his head is at rim level. And it's one of those things where it's like, oh my goodness. And it's like, you know, it's a different thing when it's Zion and it's just like bodying people, or, you know, even for a more classical example, right, of like prime Shaq just absolutely muscling people out of the way. And it's like, maybe you don't think of it in the same kind of vein of athleticism because, you know, it's power, right? But with Cam Carr, it's like the things that he makes, you know, and this is something that is true of many, many great players, of things that are impossible look easy when he's trying to do them. And I think that's kind of the difference between, you know, the more, whether it's gangly, awkward kind of athleticism or just power athleticism, versus his smoothness makes things that are difficult look a lot easier than they actually are. And that's one of those things that I feel like I have to pay attention to with the prospect of, like, it's not just that it's really impressive. It's that it would be even more impressive if he wasn't quite as coordinated as he is, but he's exceptionally coordinated, which, you know, again, I think the most underrated skill of Steph Curry is the dude is maybe the most ridiculous hand-eye coordination we've ever seen, right? It's like, oh yeah, I'm a scratch golfer in my off time because it just comes easy to me, right? And that is a really good trait for a shooter to have, and Cam Carr has that in spades.
Yeah, he's just such a silky mover on the court. I mean, we mentioned it obviously throughout the episode of like he just glides, you know, laterally and vertically. I mean, he has 40 dunks on the season as well, and especially in transition. I mean, he takes two steps and he just, you know, throws down a hammer dunk like it was nothing. He's like, oh, like, I'm just going to run back now. Like, that was nothing special.
Wonder what's for lunch.
Yeah, exactly. And especially at the rim, too. I mean, when he's coming off, you know, pick and roll possessions or, you know, coming off screens and especially DHOs, right, is that he just manipulates the defense of just taking, you know, 1 to 3 steps and bam, he's at the rim. And then he's just doing a little, you know, twirl at the rim. And, you know, he gets an easy bucket, you know, time and time again, because he has that length and size and he knows how to, you know, use his body, use his athleticism, use his power, right, to the, you know, to his strengths. And, you know, it works out well for him, right? So I think with him too, it's just a matter of can he clean up, you know, the handle stuff here and there. And then obviously on the defensive end, I mean, he is one of the best weak side defenders in the draft class, right? Just because, you know, he's averaging 2.5 stocks per game as well. And, you know, he uses that length and size to, you know, he can help out at the rim, he can stunt, he can, you know, push it, a give and go, you know, push the ball and push the pace. And in transition too, I think with him, at times you think he's gonna do one thing and then he does the other thing. He kind of like drives more into traffic where you're like, oh, like Tunde was open or like down the rim, and like he just doesn't see it. So like that's another part of his game where as he progresses, you know, in the NBA as well, is like you want to see those reads develop. And you know how it's so easy for him to, you know, make those insanely, you know, athletic plays on the offensive end, and how his shot is so repeatable. You want that to kind of translate, you know, as he evolves as, you know, an offensive playmaker.
Yeah, you mentioned his struggles with turnovers in the last 3 games, which, you know, I don't mean to underline is the wrong word. Anyway, you mentioned those. Let's just get out of that awkward transition. Yeah. He also has 8 blocks in his last 3 games.
Yeah.
8. He's 6'5".
Yeah.
It's not like, again, it's one of those things where usually when you think of these 3-and-D wing types, right? It's like if they're defensive playmakers, they're jumping passing lanes. And, you know, he had 3 steals in his last game too, right? It's not like he doesn't do that, but the shot blocking is what stands out as sort of, okay, this isn't just he's good at this. This is an outlier skill, right? Like, you know, not quite the same in many, many different ways, but it's like, it's the difference between a good shot blocking guard and like Dwayne Wade is a shot blocking guard, right? It's like, there's a big gap between this is a skill that maybe isn't necessarily normal for this position, but this guy can do really well. Like, honestly, Tyler Tanner, right? It's like, he's a really, really good shot blocker for a point guard, especially for a 6-0 point guard. He's not averaging 1.5 blocks per game. He's not putting up 8 blocks in 3 games, right? That's,
yeah.
And it's also, you know, going back to the avenues for playing time thing, right? It's like, I don't think this is going to happen very often, to be clear, but if you run out a small ball lineup with Cam Carr as a 3-4, you have a lot more rim protection than you usually expect to have in those kinds of lineups. And, you know, different players in a number of different areas, but it's the same thesis as the Jalen Williams at power forward for the Thunder, you know, before they got Isaiah Hartenstein, right? When I was like, Chet was the only player on the team who was above 6'8". And so Jalen Williams is spending a lot of time at the 4 because they don't have anybody else who can play the 4. You know, it's one of those things where, again, it just makes it easier to get guys on the floor when they have not only a well-rounded skill set, but also like that one outlier skill where it's like, oh, this lineup wouldn't make sense if they didn't have a 6'5 guard who's blocking a shot in half a game.
And I will say too, because Cameron Carr has that 7'1 wingspan, he looks a lot taller than 6'5 on film. Yeah. And like, I sometimes forget he's only 6'5. Like he looks at least like, I'm not going to say like 6'7", 6'8", or like, you know, 6'6", 6'8". But he looks a lot taller. And like, obviously, like, back when, you know, Brandon Ingram was at Duke nearly, you know, 10 years ago, right? He kind of had that same, which is crazy, which is, you know, kind of the same, you know, they had that, you know, appeal and sense of like you thought they, and like obviously Brandon Ingram is 6'9", but kind of that same resilience. Like their numbers are pretty similar. Brandon Ingram was better, you know, overall shooter, 40% on like 5 attempts per game at Duke. And he ended up being, you know, the second pick to the Lakers in the 2016 draft. But in that sense of, you know, how they moved off the ball, off the catch, and just, you know, their capabilities there and their immobility, that's how he reminds me, you know, Cameron Carter reminds me of, you know, Brandon Ingram in that sense. And on the season, Nick, you know, he has 64 blocks on this, or 39 blocks on the season, which is a 4.5 block rate, which is insane. He has a 14.9 assist rate as well. So, I mean, that's one of the outlier categories where you just like, he's doing this at 6'5", and then it's insane. So I think with him, that's definitely gonna, you know, be his do or die, not do or die kind of skill, but with you add in the shooting capability, I think his shot is real just because his shot is so repeatable at every single level that you see the same mechanics, you see the same flow, you see the same confidence that I think it's really real. And obviously at Tennessee, it's such a small sample size because, you know, he had that injury and then he didn't get a lot of playing time as well. So I think this is the, you know, true form of Cameron Carr at Baylor.
Yeah, he barely cracked 100 minutes across 2 seasons at Tennessee. Like, you know, okay, yeah, in his sophomore year, he shot 40% from three-point range. He took 5 and he made 2 of them, right? It's like that's – you can't really draw any real conclusions from that. But, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. Just how consistent he is with his mechanics. It's like, you know, he's not someone who I'm worried about. It's like, oh, no, if he's – you know, if someone's making a hard closeout at him, right, he's not rushing through things. He's not – it's funny because it's the exact opposite of, you know, him – trying to go off the dribble, right? Where it's like, it's clear that he's thinking through the process. Like when the ball gets to his hands and he knows that he's going to shoot, it's up and out of there real fast. And again, as you mentioned, it's, you know, very, you know, it's the same form every time. You know, it's not like he's kind of awkward off the dribble, or it's not like, you know, and again, this is something we've also talked about in one of the many reasons I'm glad you brought up our shared guy, Jordan Hawkins, in the notion of it's not just he's going to stand in the corner, and if the ball swings his way, he's going to shoot it, right? He's getting himself open off ball. He's, you know, not this, you know, crazy shooter off the dribble, but, you know, he's very good. I mean, literally grades out in synergy as very good off the dribble, and that's on 76 possessions, right? That's not a small sample size by any stretch of the imagination. You know, he's not, again, it's not purely spot ups, right? He's running off screens, you know, he's not taking that many threes in transition, just because when you're the kind of athlete he is, why would you ever take a three in transition, yeah, right? But like, you know, I mean, he's got quite a few possessions as a pick and roll ball handler. You mentioned, he's in the 100th percentile as a cutter.
Yeah.
I knew he was good, but 100th percentile?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you add, you know, him being a 100th percentile cutter with NBA spacing, because Baylor plays so much five out too. And it's kind of like, what do we have here? Cameron Carr is definitely, you know, gonna turn heads. And I think him, you know, having the type of year that he's having, people are just kind of getting an inkling of what he's capable of. But I mean, I mentioned, you know, as we started, you know, this section with him, that he's a top 20 lock at this point for me. And until he does something that's like derailing, that he's gonna, you know, be there for until the draft comes. But yeah,
I off the top of my head, I think I have him at like 23 or so. Yeah. So like not quite top 20 lock, but very similar range of like, yeah, this guy should be a clear first round pick. And I feel bad because, unlike with my Miles Turner example, this is someone who unfortunately it hasn't worked out for at the next level. But like, there was a month when Kendall Brown was a top 10 pick for people, and it didn't sustain. And, you know, he ended up falling into the second round and sadly has not had much of an NBA career at all. But that's sort of the main difference for me between, you know, I have talked about this before of like, I struggle with anchoring guys in the sense of like, this guy was so good in high school and it's not working out, and like, give him time. Cause it's like, you know, I saw what he could do in high school, right? Like, I kept Sean Abayev on my board for much longer than I should have this season. And part of that is the pro Cincinnati bias that I mentioned earlier. But part of it also is like, this guy is a nuts scorer, and like the defensive film has actually been pretty decent for him. So I was like, why? Like, I didn't get why it wasn't working. And so I kept him on my board for longer than I should have. The flip side is that, you know, I tend to wait longer on the Cam Cars of the world of like, okay, maybe he really is this good. Maybe he had a great 10 games and, you know, we get to conference play and things fall off. Now we're in mid-February and he's continued to be the same guy, you know, barring turnover issues in the last three games, like you mentioned. It's like, okay, so this is for real, right? And then the question from there is just, you know, all right, we've seen all the positives. And, you know, again, for me, I tend to look at the positives of the player first before sort of the negatives. And so when we get into the, you know, when we were doing the nitpicking earlier, it was like, okay, you know, these are the points that we're getting to now. But like when you burst onto the scene like that, it's not like my instinct isn't, oh, well, you know, this guy just had 5 20 point games in a row, but what can't he do? It's like, no, that's tends not to be my approach. And so that leads to me, you know, maybe waiting a little bit longer to put guys like Cam Carr and Tyler Tanner where I think they should be on my board, just as like, this could be a fluke. And we're very much at the point now where it's like, yeah, this is not a fluke. This is who he is.
And one thing too, you know, with Scott Drew developing kind of these, you know, breakout, you know, one and done players, obviously Cameron Carr sophomore, but, you know, Keontae George, BJ Edgecombe, Jacoby Walters, kind of like, this is like what he does like in the past few years. So it's kind of like, not obviously Keontae George and BJ Edgecombe are in a tiers above Jacoby Walter and what they've, you know, done at in the NBA so far. Keontae, you know, stardom in Utah, obviously. But just that proven regimen of how he's developed, you know, these guards coming out of Baylor to the NBA level, that makes me a little bit more, you know, prone to, you know, believe in Cameron Carr's, you know, outcome at the next level too, just because, you know, the proof is in the pudding type of concept, right? And then with his shooting, oh, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's that, and I completely agree with it, but it's also that there's a pretty long line of older players who have transferred to Baylor and then become college players, right? Like Davion Mitchell, Ray J. Dennis, yep. Jalen Bridges, right? It's like, it's not just, oh, these star freshmen come in and Scott Drew figures out how to get them to the NBA quickly. It's also, you know, players who had serious flashes at other places get to Baylor and then are actualized.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just a proven testament to him as well. And then people, I think because Baylor is having kind of an off year in the sense, you know, it's kind of like, okay, they won like a championship not too long ago, guys. But I think with him too, it's kind of like, okay, he has all these positives. We know what he's good at. And then we nitpick, you know, here and there of, you know, what could be a problem at the next level. But I mean, his block rate, you know, his stock rate, you know, how he is as a shooter, you know, he's an excellent category as a spot up shooter, and very good as a, you know, catch and shoot type of guy too on synergy. But I mean, it's all there, and it's all one of the things I look for too, is that I mentioned this time and time again, is just the mechanics and the poise and the confidence. And he has that, and he has the motor, and he has that grittiness as well on both ends of the floor, which I believe that, you know, that's why he's top 20 on my board.
All right. Shall we move on to quick hits?
Yeah, let's do it.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
So we talked about outlier skills for both of these guys. And for quick hits, I wanted to go back to a couple of Deep Dives alumni, we can call them, both players that you picked, which I'm sensing a pattern here of it being much more fun to talk about players that you picked later in the season than mine, because your hit rate is much better than mine this year. But two players that you picked who I, you know, wrote about in my recent article over on NoCeilingsNBA.com of just crazy outlier skills. And, you know, I want to start with Joshua Jefferson, who, man, it's one thing to sort of, you know, and obviously, you know, someone who I followed for a decent length of time, someone who, you know, I did a dive on before we had him as a deep dives player. But just going back and cutting up passing clips for that article was one of the most fun film watching experiences I've had in a long time. Like, it just, it boggles my mind the plays that would be the best pass that, you know, 95% of prospects have ever thrown. It's like, you know, the 10th best pass that Joshua Jefferson threw in like a 3-game stretch.
Yeah. I mean, when Iowa State beat Houston the other night, I mean, mm-hmm. I tweeted out, it's like time literally stopped when he made the pass to Nate Hyatt in the corner. I mean, and like, obviously the spotlight is on him. I mean, I saw this fun stat that obviously it was a no dip three, right? But like his release time was like 0.4 tenths of a second, and Steph Curry's was like 0.6, or Kyle Korver's was like 0.7, which was like circulating on Twitter, which I was like, what in the world? Like, how do people, like, whatever. But I was just like, oh my goodness, because like, I mean, Joshua Jefferson is just like an elite playmaker. Like, that guy is just an awesome basketball player. Like, I don't really know what else to say about him. I am so in on him at the next level. But I had to bring that up because I literally thought my TV like glitched out during that, because I was like, what in the world? But I mean, that's what he does. He literally stops time with his passes, because like, he can do every read in the book.
Yeah. Speaking of previous quick hits, do you know the other fun fact about that three-pointer from Heis?
No, hit me.
So on the same day as he hit that game-winning three-pointer, his sister scored for the U.S. hockey team against Canada.
That's crazy.
Some families just have all the talent, man.
Yeah. It was a good good day in the Heis household for sure.
Yeah, I hope so. If it wasn't, something is wrong with their parents.
Yes, absolutely.
So the other deep dives alum that I covered in that article that I wanted to mention, and it's a similar outlier thing, but watching it. Yaxel Lendeborg play defense, it is a wild experience of like, just in like, this is one of the clips that I cut up where it was like, it ended in Yaxel getting a block, but that wasn't even the part that like I particularly cared about. It was like, from the moment that the possession starts, he's just like switching on to every single player on the opposing team. It's like, he's shutting all of them down. And it was like, it gets to the end of the possession and it's like, Yaxel just dives out on a closeout and manages to block a three. And it's like, he did all of his work before that block, right? He shut off every passing lane. He switched on to, I think, literally four different people in the space of like 7-8 seconds. And it was just nuts to me. And, you know, again, what I sort of mentioned in the article is like, hey, if you're selling your Yaxel stock because he's had like a 7-game cold stretch from 3-point range, send all of it my way. I will take all of it, because like, you know, again, what you talked about before, right? Of like, you know, when Tyler Tanner had that really bad game, but he also, you know, had 6 assists and 3 steals, right? It's like, on a bad shooting night for Yaxel Lendeborg, he is still shutting down like 5, 10, 15 defensive possessions that would have been easy points if he wasn't there, and instead are just nothing.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason, like, I'm with you, like, give me all the Yaxel Lendeborg stock, is because I saw him in person 2 times this year, and he is such a leader on both sides of the ball, right? Especially on the defensive end, because he wants every single matchup. He doesn't care who he's guarding. He's gonna, you know, he's gonna take it to you, right? Because he's just that type of player, and he has such a great mindset around of like what he's supposed to do, you know, here, how he's supposed to be positioned, or, you know, be in rotation. He just gets it. He's a player that just gets it. And I think, you know, obviously he's been going through a cold spell, as you mentioned, shooting wise. I don't think that's gonna, you know, be there for that long, just because I think we've seen enough out of him that, you know, he notices that. Obviously it's apparent to everyone. Obviously he knows it, that he's not shooting the best. It's gonna get better, right? And obviously he has, you know, Ade Mara and Rez Johnson in the front court too that he plays along with, which obviously, you know, helps. I mean, they're the number one team in the country too. Obviously Arizona got knocked down to number 4 as well. So, you know, they're kind of the new kids on the block at the top spot. But I mean, that also helps immensely when you have, you know, those two guys to rely on the defensive end. But I mean, his leadership is so apparent. And I just want to harp on that again, because I was so impressed with him when I watched Michigan this past year.
So I know you said before we started recording that you wanted to talk about a couple of games, and we sort of talked about one of them, but I know the other game you wanted to talk about was Arizona Texas Tech, which you sort of obliquely just referenced, but now we can dive deep into a pretty shocking result.
Yeah. Arizona State, Texas Tech last night. Obviously, JT Toppin got hurt. Unfortunate. Don't know the exact details about it, but he had to be helped off the court. But yeah, upset in Tempe, which was very surprising on my end. But I didn't get too deep in the weeds in it because I was watching UCLA, Michigan State, and one of the most absurd things happened in that game that has, I don't think, ever happened before, Nick. And that was that UCLA head coach Mick Cronin actually ejected his own player, Steven Jamerson. And it was the most absurd thing I've ever seen. He was close to, if not fouled out, I'm pretty sure. And Mick Cronin was like, okay, you're out. Like, get out of here. Like, you're not even going to sit on the bench. Like, I don't want you here. And I was like, if you're a UCLA fan, I don't know how you're dealing with Mick Cronin at the moment, because like that was absurd to me. I mean, like looking, like even as a player perspective, you're like, so if I don't do all these things right, or, you know, I just got to get kicked out. Like, I want to like cheer on my teammates, right? And that kind of doesn't help the morale. Obviously, you know, Michigan State won last night, but yeah, I was like shocked.
This is going to go darker than I mean it to, but there are quite a few displays in the world right now of a massive disparity in the ego to talent ratio. And Mick Cronin has done an exemplary job of putting himself in contention for worst ego to talent ratio in college sports. It's truly wild. I mean, there was also the clip of, you know, some reporter just asked him some benign question about the Michigan State student section. And he's like, the stupidest question I've ever heard. And I was like, yeah. My guy, like, I don't think I've ever seen him take accountability for anything in any context. It's like, it's always someone else's fault. And, you know, it's like, it's the classic thing about like, oh man, I've had 17 awful roommates in a row. It's like, maybe you're the bad roommate.
Yeah, no, that's a great comparison, because that same interview with a reporter, Mick Cronin was like, are you raising your voice at me? And he was just talking to him in a normal voice. It's kind of like, it's so awkward. Like, this was so awkward of a night for UCLA in general. Like, don't make it worse than it already is. But I mean, there's tons of examples of, you know, that, you know, over the past years. But I mean, it's like, okay, you think the ejection was like awkward and weird, and then the interview was the same type of thing post game.
Yeah. If there is one talent that Mick Cronin has, he is exceptionally gifted at making things worse.
Yes.
And on that note, before all of Westwood comes after us, probably in support, honestly. Yeah. But thanks, Cronin. Yeah. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap up here?
No, all good here.
All right. Well, she is Paige Otto. You can find her on social media at PaigeOtto_, and you can find her written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on social media at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. I had an article that came out yesterday as we were recording 2 days ago, as you all are listening to this. And as mentioned, covered a couple of Deep Dives alums in pretty decent depth. So that was a ton of fun. Honestly, most of the fun was cutting up Joshua Jefferson clips, yeah. But you know, take the wins where you can get them. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review if you are listening to the podcast, or leave a like and subscribe if you are watching the video on YouTube. And if you have any feedback regarding the Deep Dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to either of us via the aforementioned social media channels, or you can shoot me an email, nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.